So most of you who are here know that today is part two of the talk I gave last Sunday. And just as a refresher, one of the ancestors in the ancestral line that we were chanting this morning, Daimon Konin, Chinese, lived in the 600s. So quite a long time ago. He was the abbot of a monastery, and from the sounds of it, a very big monastery, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of monks, which seemed to be the norm in a lot of Buddhist countries and monasteries. It was a very popular thing. His sense was that, I'm reading between the lines, but he was getting older. He wanted to have a successor to his teaching. So he basically told all of his community to please write a poem expressing your understanding of reality, your understanding of true nature. And he said, basically, the one who has the best poem in terms of their understanding will receive the succession, will become his successor. And let me read that poem again, as we'll be drawing on it in the talk today. I'll give you two versions of the poem. So basically, there was one monk in the community who was regarded by the other monks as the most senior monk. And all of them basically stepped down and said they weren't going to write a poem because they felt that this senior monk was definitely the one who should be the successor. And so his poem goes, "Our mind is a Bodhi tree, our mind like a dressing stand with its clear mirror. Time upon time, let us strive to wipe it clean and let not dust or dirt abide thereon." And the other poem, other version, "Our body is the Bodhi tree and our mind a mirror bright. Carefully we wipe them hour by hour and let no dust alight." Kind of reflecting on it since last Sunday, the comment, the line about our body is the Bodhi tree, our body is the vehicle, is the means we have of realizing enlightenment. And hence the saying that it's the body is the Bodhi tree being that which the Buddha sat under and realized enlightenment. And our mind a mirror bright, again, talking about the fact that in meditation, our primary practice is that of being aware, like a mirror, having things arise, having things abide and then pass. And what I mentioned last time was that what this is really talking about, pointing to, is the incredible importance of practicing the precepts, following the precepts, conducting our lives in an ethical and moral way. But let me reread that last version of the poem, and I'm going to read it in a slightly different way. And this is grammatically correct. He says, "Our body is the Bodhi tree." He's speaking on all of our behalves. What he's saying is, my body is the Bodhi tree and my mind a mirror bright. Carefully I wipe it hour by hour and let no dust alight. So what's being talked about here is often pointed to as basically we're trying to spiritually perfect ourselves. I'm going to follow the precepts so well that I don't do anything wrong. I don't do anything bad. I'm a perfect person spiritually. We could talk about it in a little more contemporary way and say that this poem is very significantly talking about self-improvement and has been commented many, many times by teachers in our order when I would be listening to them talk about things. There is no end to self-improvement. There's no end to the dust that we have to clean up. A year and a half ago, I vacuumed this carpet. For some reason, I had to vacuum it this morning, too. Just as an example. So this senior monk wrote this poem on the wall of the corridor leading to the meditation hall. And I wanted to read you how the story continues after that. So the abbot, presumably the next day, was walking down the corridor, saw this poem, and he realized, this is definitely a poem written by this senior monk. And so he goes to this senior monk and says, was this your poem? And he says, yes, it was. It's the one I wrote. So the abbot says to him, he says, your poem shows that you have not yet realized the essence of mind. So far, you have reached the door of enlightenment, but you have not yet entered it. To attain supreme enlightenment, one must be able to know spontaneously one's own nature or essence of mind, which is neither created nor can it be annihilated. And I mentioned last time that in a different reading I did, that basically the abbot, he praised the poem. He actually asked all of his monks to memorize it and to recite it. And he said, somebody who proceeds in this way and does this practice, surely at some point will realize enlightenment, will attain an understanding into our true nature, into reality, and so on. But then when he speaks privately to this monk, he's saying that what you have done is you've reached the door of enlightenment, but you haven't yet stepped into it. And I think two points come to mind is it's really, really, really good to get to the door of enlightenment. We have a whole bunch of Zen stories that are talking about this in different ways. One of which that comes to mind is they say, when you reach the top of a 100-foot pole, how do you take the next step? You know, what do? When you get to the door of enlightenment, what do? My experience has been that both for myself and a lot of the rest of us, is we get to the door and then we turn around and run away. Then we come back again by virtue of the fact that we go meditate again. We keep coming over and over and over again to that threshold. Then he leaves him. The abbot leaves the senior monk by saying this final thing, you had better go back to think it over again for a couple of days and then submit me another poem. If your poem shows that you have entered the door of enlightenment, he says, I will make you my successor. So he's saying, okay, you're at the top of the 100-foot pole. Take the next step. So our scene cuts back to Daikon Enno in the rice shed. We left him there pounding rice in the rice shed. So Enno overheard the recitation of the poem and asked a fellow lay trainee, what the verse was. And so this trainee basically told him the story. And then Daikon Enno asks him, can you recite the poem for me? And so he has the poem recited for him. So Daikon Enno hears this poem and he says, it is indeed beautiful, but it is not quite complete. Which again is exactly what the abbot was saying in just a slightly different way. Then it proceeds, it says, that night, Enno asked a boy attendant in the temple to lead him to the corridor where the poem was written. Then whilst he himself, Daikon Enno, held a candle, he had the boy write down the following poem next to the other poem. So as I'd mentioned, Daikon Enno was illiterate. They're referring to this boy attendant, so presumably the boy attendant knows how to write. And so this is the poem. It says, Bodhi is truly not a tree, nor is the clear mirror a mirror dressing stand. From the first, not a single thing exists. So from where is dust or dirt to arise? Now, there's one important thing that you wouldn't notice in this poem as I was reading it, that you do notice when you see it, is that part of the code is that when a word is all in capital letters, what that's doing is it's referring to our true nature. It's referring to true reality. And the word Bodhi is all in capital letters. So he's saying Bodhi, or our true nature, that fundamental nature, that true reality, is truly not a tree. And then the two words clear mirror are also all in capitals. Nor is the clear mirror a mirror dressing stand. So what's being implied there is our bodies and our minds. Remember, you know, our body is a Bodhi tree. Our mind is a mirror bright. He's saying that our bodies and minds are not that true fundamental reality. Now, there's a little bit of more explaining I need to do with that here in a moment, but we all have bodies, we all have minds. Have we experienced that true nature yet, just by virtue of having a body and a mind? And that's in part what's being implied here. It's something other than. Those aren't really the best words to use, but you know what I'm meaning. It's something other than our bodies and our minds. That true fundamental reality is something other than that. From the first, not a single thing exists. And that's really, really the heart of the poem. And I would like to unpack that. I'll unpack it to begin with by saying that actually what he's pointing to, as maybe esoteric and mystical it sounds, is actually something very straightforward. And we've all, to one degree or another, have already experienced what he's pointing to. So remember that I mentioned that the first poem can be looked at from the point of view of, it's talking about following the precepts, but it can be taken from the point of view of spiritual self-improvement. In order to be in that frame of mind, or in order to proceed with self-improvement, though, what we're always doing is standing apart from something else, something that's seen, something that's experienced, and saying, this is good, this is bad, this is dust, I must clean it, this is good stuff, I need more of that. So there's always this very, very active self there. You know, there's always a me there. I remember when I first started what in hindsight I can see now as kind of my first steps into a meditation practice. It was initially one of these guided meditations that was very specifically geared towards, you know, relaxing and calming oneself. And, it, you know, it was something that one of my relatives had come across, and they were like, oh, would you like to try this with me? I'm like, okay, give it a try. And without going into too many details about the particular type of relaxation meditation, what I remember was, as I was doing this, things would come up where I would be thinking about, you know, the part-time job I had at the time, the other activities I was doing, the schoolwork I was doing, and so on. And what would come up was some of these things and some of the incidents going on in these things were really stressing me out. And so, I needed to kind of distance myself from that and find a calm place where I could relax and calm down and so on. distancing myself, you know, as I was, as it turned out, was lying there. Kind of fast forward from that form of meditation to when I particularly remember this as a very young monk and meditating. And I had it in my mind that, okay, meditation had to do with finding that calm place, that peaceful place. And, you know, we all, like we do here, we all sit in a hall where there's everyone around you. And, you know, so-and-so was breathing rather heavily down, a few chairs down, and, oh, there's some noise going on outside. And I very much remember that I would mentally kind of like, oh, I need to kind of block all of that out and focus on just being calm and still here and let that other annoying stuff go away, or so it wasn't bothering me. The important thing, both when I was a young monk and doing this initial type of meditation, is that what I can now see very, very clearly is there was very much this active sense of me and what I wanted. The minute you set up a me that has certain expectations and certain wants, you've automatically created this world of all these other things separate from you. And the heavy breathing going on a few chairs down, or the noise going on outside, and so on, becomes something that you don't like. And it's disturbing my meditation. I think the beauty is that if you carry on with this practice long enough, you will work through all of your misunderstandings and incorrect views of how to do the practice and so on. And basically, that understanding we come to ties into what I said at the beginning of the ceremony. It's that every time we, as a specific example, the one I gave was that if I'm sitting there meditating and some very loud noise starts coming up outside or something of that sort, I could just feel the arising of a stance, a position. It's almost like a self kind of pulling out of that and saying, I don't like this. This is disturbing me. This is causing problems. In meditation instruction, we specifically talk about when thoughts come up, when feelings come up, when emotions come up. You know, and those are very simple terms, but over time we have to kind of realize what they're actually referring to in ourselves. And when those come up, we're told don't hold on to them. Basically, don't interact with them. Don't keep perpetuating them in one form or another. So if something comes up that's irritating me, bothering my attempt to be calm and peaceful, the teaching is don't act on that. Don't keep perpetuating that. And over time, we start realizing that everywhere we're holding on to things or pushing things away, those are the ways in which we're actually separating off from what's actually just going on. There's what's going on, and then there's this, I sort of have this image of this inflatable doll that has the word self written on it, or Hugh written on it, or something like that. And okay, there's a noise going on. There's a physical feeling coming up. Are you going to inflate that doll? Which in essence, what it's doing is whenever that comes up by grabbing onto it, by acting on it, what that does is we actually separate ourselves from just what's happening. And we're separating ourselves from it also with a view of this other thing that's going on, where we're saying it's a certain this way or a certain that way. It's good or it's bad. it's pleasant or unpleasant. Meditation is saying, you don't have to do that. You don't have to keep actually separating yourself over and over and over again from the life that's happening. So the reason we recommend doing silent seated meditation on a regular basis is because we're paring down, we're basically allowing ourselves to sit in a very quiet, very undistracted way, so that we can become more and more aware of all of the ways in which we keep pulling back from life, all of the ways we keep creating this sense of separateness, and over time try to, my deepest desire is to enter fully into life, to enter fully into reality and simply be a part of it, an interconnected part of it, to actually be within that, as we're well aware, that profoundly deep moving life energy of reality. And meditation, over time, as we continue doing it, you know, as I continue doing it, I realize that, oh, we're constantly being given the opportunity to just simply jump into life itself. Instead of, hang on a minute, I keep pulling myself back from what's really there. I mean, give you an example. I'm out and about in town, maybe shopping, something of that sort. I see a person, and my immediate sense of what comes up is, oh, that looks like a really nice person. I would like to meet them. I would like to get to know them. That's one case of, say, desire arising. So there's the experiencing of something pleasurable or enjoyable, you know, in seeing this person. And then by acting on that, I create something separate from that enjoyable experience and say, oh, this separate thing wants to meet and know that person. Whereas the experiencing of the pleasantness and niceness in and of itself, that was what was going on right then. That was reality right then. Why do I create this separate sense of being separate from that when, in fact, I was already experiencing what was going on? I don't know how well I've just verbalized that, but at least in my mind, when I look at that pattern in myself, I'm like, Rohini, that's really funny in a sad way. Everything was fine. One has a brief interaction with somebody, you exchange pleasantries, that was really nice. Don't take the next step and then raise a self who feels that they're lacking or missing something and wanting more of something. Just come back to the reality that's there right now that followed on after that other encounter. Just keep coming back to the reality that's right here, right now. So that's why Daikon Enno is saying, from the first, not a single thing exists. And you have to see that he's saying this very technically, very specifically. Maybe another way of saying is that from the first, or the way reality has always been, is that reality is never separate and divided. It's our minds and the way we've been sort of taught by example to use our minds that keeps creating this, keeps raising up, keeps inflating this separate sense. And so over and over again, what we do in our meditation practice is anytime we see ourselves grabbing onto something or pushing something away, it's like, see that as actually that's the expression of a self. That's the expression of something that will lead to separation, distancing ourselves from simply what's here and now. A thing is a separate thing. And that's what the word thing means. It's a separate from another thing. And we have labels, we have names for them. And Daikon Enno is saying, actually, the universe has never been separated. It's never been all these different pieces, all these different things. It's all one whole thing. And because all of us actually do feel that we're separate and apart from the world in various unique ways, then what we need to do is start practicing, continue practicing meditation, continue the practicing of being aware of when the mind kicks up its desires or aversions, when it kicks up its wanting to perpetuate that separate self sense. And as best we can, we don't buy into that. We don't go for that. There are various ways that historically Buddhism has talked about it, but from a certain point of view, Buddhism has talked about there are certain aspects of this tendency we have in our minds that is actually stealing from us our ability to know that we're actually whole and fully part of life. It has to do with the more we've developed our minds, the greater there is that tendency to feel we're separate. Oftentimes, historically, Zen has been talked about, promotes itself as the true reality we experience is actually separate from, it's outside the scriptures. And there's this beautiful story, I'm saying beautiful with this wicked smile on my face, where this is a Tibetan Buddhist story, way, way, way back in the early unfoldings of Tibetan Buddhism. A very young monk went with his master to India to basically, they were on a pilgrimage to find some of the really ancient scriptures about some of the deeper teachings of Buddhism. And specifically, it was the young monk, the young disciple who wanted to go find these very sacred scriptures about the really deep esoteric teaching. And he found them. And he had quite a haul, lots and lots of volumes of these books with the deeper teaching. So they got them and they were on their way back to Tibet. And on their journey back, they'd gotten back into Tibet, but weren't quite back to their monastery. And Tibet is very high altitude. It can be very, very cold all year round, particularly at night. And so, you know, they were on foot. They might have had some other people with them helping to carry the scriptures and so on. And so they marched, hiked for a given day, and then lit a campfire at night and went to bed. And so it's somewhere in the middle of the night, and the disciple wakes up. And he wakes up and he notices, kind of waking out of his grogginess, that he notices his master sitting by the fire, and he's tearing pages out of the books and putting them on the fire. And the master looks at him and says, you know, we ran out of wood and it was getting really cold, so I was keeping the fire going. And the disciple was just utterly horrified. You're destroying this deepest of all scriptures. And the gist of the story was he was trying to convey to the disciple that right here, right now, is reality. You have all of it right now. What is it that keeps coming up that we keep holding on to or keep pushing away that keeps us acting in a way that we actually don't already have that fundamental nature in us that we're part of? So that's what the practice of meditation is for, is ultimately realizing that from the first, you've never been separate from your true nature, from that fundamental nature. It's all already been there for each and every one of us. And over time, we finally realize that. And in realizing that and deepening that realization, we can continue living our lives from that place. Now, I do have to put a footnote to all of that and say that I presented that story, that Tibetan Buddhist story, to convey a very specific thing. And the disciple willingly chose this master to train with. I'm sure they'd been training for some time. The master knew his disciple. He knew what would help his disciple to find that true nature in himself. And some of the stories in Buddhism can seem quite extreme. So really realize that what it was doing in that particular instance was he was trying to show the disciple that you keep thinking that you're missing something. You keep thinking you need something. It's already all there. Just let go of the stuff that you keep grabbing onto that makes you think that you're missing something. Now, I've just read excerpts from two books. You know, I haven't been tearing them out to keep the fire going. And I'm saying that to convey that there is a good use for books in helping us clarify our understanding of how we can meditate more deeply. But remember, Daikon Enno was illiterate. He couldn't even read, which is very interesting because he wasn't even tempted or bothered by books. He could maybe do what I did when I was 5 years old living in Sweden, and my parents sent me to a grade school. I just, you know, spent most of the day looking at the pictures in the books, had no idea what they were saying. So I'm wanting us to go back to the story of when Daikon Enno first went to the monastery and met the abbot. So Daikon Enno basically went straight away to this monastery where he sought an audience with Daimon Konin, the abbot. And the abbot asked him, "Where do you come from?" And Daikon Enno answered, "From south of the southern pass." Daimon Konin asked, "What do you want above all else?" Basically, why are you here? What are you looking for? Reverend Master Jiyu, when she went to the monastery in Japan, was asked the same question. She was a Westerner. This was back in the very early 1960s. And a few Westerners had started coming to Japan after World War II, interested in Zen and so on. And so the abbot, some of the very senior monks at the monastery were aware of Westerners coming. And sometimes the Westerners would say, "Oh, I want to learn about tea ceremony. Or I want to learn about archery. Or I want to learn about flower arranging." Reverend Master Jiyu's response was, "I want the perfection of Zen." She says, "Give me everything you've got. I want it all. I want to know the depth of what Zen has to offer." Okay, so what do you want above all else? Enno replied, "I seek only to become a Buddha." Sounds like he wants the whole thing. So Daimon Konin, the abbot, then said, "Southerners do not have the Buddha nature. So how can you realize Buddhahood?" This is a really beautiful kind of juxtaposition. This comes before the two poems. Daikon Enno, in his poem, says that our bodies and our minds are not the Buddha nature. And this abbot is correctly saying that Southerners don't have the Buddha nature. Your body and mind doesn't have the Buddha nature. Since you don't have it, how can you realize Buddhahood? So Daikon Enno answered, "Amongst people, there are Southerners and there are Northerners. What has the Buddha nature to do with that?" You know, exactly. And here's the part I left out last Sunday, which is very important. So the abbot recognized that here indeed was no ordinary person, But chiding told him to go to the rice pounding shed. You know, and as I'd mentioned last time, that was one of the most menial jobs in the monastery. Now, Daikon Enno has already entered into the doorway that we were talking about previously. He hasn't, like the senior monk, gotten to the edge of the door. He's actually walked through the door. And when you walk through the door, there is simply just this. 10 minutes from now, there will be just this. And the just this for Daikon Enno, the just this was, go to the rice pounding shed. That was just simply what was. So the abbot says, go to the rice pounding shed. Daikon Enno bowed low and left for the shed, where for 8 months he labored hard, pounding rice day and night without ceasing. He bowed low. There's a phrase that, you know, I remember from day one, it comes from Buddhism. It says, as long as bowing lasts, Buddhism will last. Buddhism being becoming Buddha. We become Buddha, we are Buddha every time we bow, i.e., we are simply open to and step into just this when we meet what's just here right now. That's becoming Buddha, that's being Buddha. That's entering into the reality of what is. Now, Daikon Enno bowed low. He presumably bowed to the abbot. But I think we can misunderstand that in the sense of it doesn't have to do with hierarchy, abbot better, disciple worse. It has to do with bowing to the truth of what's there right now. Well, does Daikon Enno become the successor? There is no Daikon Enno per se. Daikon Enno is that which simply bows to what is. He has stepped through that door. Simply, it's just all of reality that is there for him moment to moment to moment. If he's like, oh, great, I'm going to get the job promotion. Or if the other senior monk is, I didn't get the promotion, this other guy did. Well, they've just run out of the door again. From the point of view of our perspective of seeming selves and separate people and so on, yes, he did become the next ancestor in our lineage. But he became the next ancestor because, as the abbot had said, the person who expresses their understanding of, who know that truth, they are my successor. In other words, they are somebody who knows what Buddhism is all about and what it has to offer. And therefore, they can be of help in pointing out to other people who come how to find out that place for themselves. So be forewarned, though, because you might be asked to go to the rice pounding shed. You might wake up some morning and find that somebody is tearing up your precious books. Or in my case, it would be something even worse than both of those two things. Because each and every one of us has our own particular things that we just can't let go of or don't want to let go of. Another way of saying it, we all have those particular things that we still want to hold on to because we want to continue being ourselves.
Well, actually, you don't even have that. Speaking from my own experience, the things that we use to define ourselves, the things that we think we have to have, you know, that we lose that, then who are we? Actually, we've never had that. It's just an idea that we construct to make us feel like we have a self, you know, to make us feel secure. But I mean, that's all they say. We construct this world, and it's just natural. Human beings with the brains that they have, they're going to construct these worlds that they can live in with a certain amount of security. But I mean, one of the things that Queen Anne was saying is that, well, that's just a construct. Mm-hmm. You don't actually have that. And sometimes those things are just, you learn now when those things are taken away, you know, mm-hmm. not by your volition, you know, not by your choice, but for some reason they're taken away and you're to be cast off. Then we learn, oh, well, I never actually had that. It was just something I was holding.
And fleshing out what you're saying in sort of from my perspective, you're already no longer junior high students. You're all no longer college students. But there's sort of a naturalness of, we don't recognize sometimes that there are a lot of things we've actually let go of already in our lives. And, you know, there is life after junior high. There is life after high school. And actually, by extension, there is always life after letting go of the seeming most important thing. You'll still be there. And in the deepest sense, everything will be fine.
Yeah.